Good evening, everybody. My name is Tom Whalen, and I'm an alcoholic. Wow, that's a lot of people. Spent the weekend in Toronto and at a little conference, a pretty big conference, actually, but there was, everyone wanted to know about the Pacific Group and what it was really like, and was it as big and active and fabulous as they have all heard, and I said yes, and that and more. They all wanted to know about Clancy and if I knew him, and I said, yes, I know Clancy. He's my sponsor. And you've no idea, those of you in the room, because you're here all the time, but you don't know what an impact Clancy and this group, all of you people and the people in it, have around the country and around Alcoholics Anonymous. What a fabulous thing you have here. I just hope that it doesn't get screwed up some way. It's just fabulous. I got my start here in the Pacific Group a few years ago. It was much smaller then, of course, but it was still a Pacific Group. And I'm still very much impressed with the fact that I'm a member of that group, although I live in Dana Point, Laguna Beach area now. My regular home group is the Wednesday night Laguna meeting, but it didn't stop me from feeling a part of here. I know so many people. I'm a little, I have an ego as much as anybody else, but being Chris Whalen's father isn't a whole lot to me. I just, oh yes, of course, I heard about you, you know, it's just, but, like I'm just chopped liver or something. It didn't seem to be fair. I don't know how it all happened, my alcoholism. I don't have an excuse for being an alcoholic. I started off in West Los Angeles, I felt it was a normal home, although I felt sort of out of sorts, certain dis-ease about the way I felt. I was embarrassed about my parents for whatever reason, I don't know. I drank experimentally when I was in grammar school, and I became a daily drinker by the time I was a junior in high school, and I continued to drink, thinking it was for fun. I'm certainly knowing it was a certain amount of fun because I enjoyed the effect that it produced in my body and my mind, and I drank at every opportunity. I must have felt a little strange because I had a bad reputation when I was in high school for being a pretty good drunk, being a pretty good drinker. And I joined the Army. As I look back now, it was really a geographic to get away from the girl I was seeing and my life as I knew it then. But I continued to drink more. This girl came down to Arkansas where I was stationed, and we got married. And when I got out of the Army, I was drinking more than I'd ever drank, and not knowing much about what it all meant. I just know that I like getting loaded. I remember once I was in the Army and I was alone and I had a little private room. And drinking must have bothered me in that I found a note the next day that said, "I am stoned out of my mind and having a wonderful time, so there." That's where I was. So I must have had some feeling that somebody else thought I was got it wrong, but I continue to drink, and I don't know I'm any different than anybody else in the room. I was sort of pursuing that elusive butterfly of alcoholism that kind of makes you feel good, and I love being stoned. I just like laying on my bed and watching the room spin around, and it gives you that great feeling. Put your foot down, it stops, you know, and it's just great. And as long as I could function and drive and work and do what I had to do, I drank. And it always got out of hand. I was always getting in trouble for my drinking and always embarrassing myself, but I continued to try to drink at every opportunity. And when I got out of the Army, I went back to work for my father in the electrical contracting business, which I was sort of ashamed of. I wanted to do something different, but that was my reality. That's what I was to do. And I don't know whether I drank over any of these things that I've been talking about, the bad marriage. Was I drinking over that? Was I drinking because my father was an electrician? I drank because my mother was fat and went to the altar society all the time? I don't know. I just drank because I drank. Apparently, after the years have gone by, I've come to find out that I drank because I was an alcoholic. And I drank alcoholically because I was an alcoholic, and I had a disease. I didn't know any of this, of course. I just was cursed or blessed with this disease called alcoholism, and I didn't have much choice in any of it. So I think my background really doesn't have much to do about it. I was starting having a lot of trouble with my drinking, in that I was using it as a medicine. I didn't know this at the time, and I would have denied it at the time, but I found out that I was developing a shaking problem and a stuttering problem, and I was doing this electrical work, and you can't to work on hot wires when you're shaking apart. So I sort of drank, I think, a lot of times just to relax. Although sometimes I got so relaxed I couldn't move, but I did drink just to kind of fit in and to relax and to have that nice feeling. And I was trying now to sort of keep myself in good physical condition. And I did that for a while, and I think it worked pretty well. But as the years went on, I knew I was something wrong with it. I was crazy. I was just had these terrible depressions and these highs and these lows and these strange ill at ease feelings, and I was involved with this bad marriage, and I had these two kids that were growing up, and I sort of felt estranged from them in some way. I tried to be a good father, but I felt, well, I just wasn't. I couldn't manage money. I was constantly overdrawn the checking account. I had bad check charges all the time. I was borrowing money from everyone that would loan it to me and trying to pay it back and not being able to pay it back and having to have my father bail me out over and over and over and over again and feeling less of a man and drinking. I don't know that I was drinking more because of any of this kind of stuff. I just felt like having another drink. It just seemed like a pretty good idea, and I'd have another drink. And I kept having another drink, whether I was in a bar or whether I was sitting in the front seat of my car or whether I was at home sneaking drinks from my wife or running out in the backyard and pretending to barbecue the filet of sole so I could go out and sneak that drink that was in the garage. And that sneaky kind of drinking and that desperate kind of drinking just to stay together so I could somehow appear to be okay. And I sought the help of a psychiatrist for a lot of these problems that I have been relating. And I saw this doctor and had a private therapy or group therapy. We had all different kinds, about 3 or 4 years. And what happened to me, because I was dishonest about my number one problem, which was my alcoholism, because I'm not telling anybody how much I drank, I lied to him about my drinking. I told him I was drinking 6 or 8 ounces of alcohol a day, doctor. It seemed like a normal amount for heavy drinking to drink, and I'm more than happy to be a heavy drinker because it is a sign of manhood or adulthood to control and enjoy my drinking was my great obsession then. And I didn't understand. I didn't have any knowledge that the fact that I was trying to control my drinking, I wasn't enjoying it. And when I enjoyed my drinking, I certainly wasn't controlling it, but I couldn't see any of that. I kept trying to get that feeling again. Not the drunk feeling particularly, just so I would feel all right. And of course it would overshoot it, and I would embarrass my wife. We'd have an argument, the Sunday morning critiques about what you really did last night. Why can't you drink like so-and-so? Why do you drink before dinner, during dinner, and after dinner? And what are you taking in the car with you? Why can't you wait till you get to the restaurant? And all these interminable stupid questions that didn't mean to me. I just felt like having another drink, and it was just kept drinking. And this doctor tried to help me. Of course, he didn't have a Chinaman's chance of helping me because I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker because I just needed to drink, and I needed to somehow fit in and be the kind of a husband I really wanted to be, and be the kind of a father I wanted to be, and be a good manager of this business. And yet I failed miserably at everything. I was a total flake, totally irresponsible, and not knowing what the hell to do. And we started having separations in the marriage, and back and forth, and back and forth, and the lawyers, and then calling it off, and moving back into the house, and then staying around for a few more months or a year or whatever, and then moving out again, and all that sort of stuff, and the chaos it caused those poor kids in that family. And it was just a terrible way to live, a terrible way to be married, a terrible way to raise kids. But that was my story. The alcohol still worked. What I mean by that, if you're using alcoholic medicine like I was, it worked. I don't mind the blackouts. That's a small price to pay for something that makes you feel so good, I'll tell you that. Hell, half the stuff that we forget isn't even worth remembering. Just... And I don't mind vomiting on my shoes or your shoes if you're standing too close. It's all fine as long as it does the trick. But it stopped working. I couldn't predict how I was going to be in a couple of hours. And I was sitting in his doctor's office one day, and he looked at me and he said, you're drunk. I said, what do you mean I'm drunk? He said, you look drunk, you act drunk, and you smell drunk. I assume you're drunk. And I said, well, I had a couple of beers for lunch. I think it's our stock answer. And he said, I think it's a little bit more than that, a little bit more recent. He was going to help me with my drinking problem, albeit my non-existent drinking problem, but I'll go along with the gag, whatever. So he put me on heavy doses of lyrium and heavy doses of stelazine, and I was going to be just fine. If I had been like I thought I was, just mildly neurotic, I'll be fine. I took the pills as prescribed. Of course, I didn't take them more than prescribed. I want to get well now. I'm going to be waiting around a month. Went back to see him a week later, and I said, I feel better this week than I have felt in a long time. I have a certain inner peace that seems to permeate my life. A certain tranquility on the job, a certain friendliness at home again. He said, that's amazing. Not this soon do people get this immediate result from these tranquilizing drugs. And I said, well, I guess I'm very fortunate. I said, incidentally, I need another prescription. He said, you couldn't possibly. I gave you a month's supply. I said, well, I don't know if you're here somewhere. And I looked around. So he wrote out another prescription. I had his too, and I had some for some other doctors. So I started popping these pills like M&M's, and I want to tell you, I got real strange. Drive down Wilshire Boulevard and get to a little innocuous corner like Wilshire and Westwood, and sit there and wait for the signal to change about 10 in the morning. Take about an hour and a half, and I went and woke up. The lady in front of me wanted to have her car fixed too, and that to be just so. Some nights I'd come home and rip that house apart, terrorize that wife and family. Some nights come home just as peaceful as I am this evening, even more peaceful. Come home 4:35, 6 o'clock at night, go lay down the living room rug, take a little nap before dinner time. Sometimes I'd miss dinner, but there's other meals. And get up at 11, 12 o'clock at night, go take a leak in the linen closet and go to bed. Just another evening at home. It's going to be hard for you to believe this, but my wife was losing her sense of humor over a lot of this sort of stuff. But she filed for divorce again. And so we moved out again. This time I had a one-room place right behind my favorite drinking bar called the Cork and Fork over on Elizabeth Boulevard. And I had a certain routine of getting up in that one little room every morning, sitting on the edge of my wet bed from perspiration or what have you, and get up, go to the linen closet, pour a long, tall drink of vodka, have another one, another one, another one. By 8 o'clock in the morning, I felt like going to work. I felt better. I had neurine in the eyes and dark glasses on for anybody who could look in there and see there was nobody home. And, a little cheap cologne on, go off and go to work and hope I would last until lunchtime. And sometimes I did. But lots of times, most mornings, no. 11, 10, whatever, I start to shake and excuse me, I'll be right back. I've just got to run down the hardware store for something. And I'd lay down in the front seat of my car and drink a little hot vodka, and that would get my motor running where I could last until lunchtime, when I could sit the same bars. Not at the bar. Now, that's where the alcoholics sit. I sat at a booth, and I read my little Herald Examiner, and I'd look at the guys at the bar, and I'd think, now, they're alcoholics. Now, I knew they were alcoholics because they were in there every single solitary day for lunch. The only reason I knew that is that I was in there every day for lunch, but they were the alcoholics, and I'm just this poor guy with these problems, this neurotic, this poor, miserable, depressed character whose wife's divorcing him, who's hopelessly in debt. I owed over $12,000 and no way of paying it back, and I was losing my wife and my family and my home, my business, because people don't need drunken electricians around their projects, and I just didn't know what was going to happen to me. I had some childish, again, this little boy's idea that somehow, some way, someday I'd be taken out of the situation and put into a different place, but I didn't know how that was going to be. And so I continued on. My wife came to visit me in October of 65, and she told me what kind of a husband I was, what kind of a father I was, what kind of a son I was. She pretty much told my inventory, and I just flipped out. I went temporarily insane. I took an overdose of second-all sleeping pills, a big bottle I'd bought the night before, and I just checked out. And I'm sure there was a lot of us in this room this evening that have been at that place that I have been, where there's no real reason to go on another 5 minutes. And so I just lay down that little bed and I just drifted out. And I just didn't want to have to deal with it anymore. I just didn't want to wake up to it anymore. I just wanted it all go away. I wanted to go away, I guess. And a kid that was working for me part-time thought I was acting a little bizarrely and came to my apartment. They got the door open and found me in a coma, and they sent me up to UCLA Medical Center, where they put me full of holes, and I was to stay in this coma for, I guess, about 13 hours. And I came to, and they put me in another ambulance and shipped me off to a mental institution where I was to stay for a while. But not for alcoholism, something respectable, suicide. And I was in there for a while. And I made my little ashtray well enough they eventually let me out. And so I drove down Olympic Boulevard, and I'm not an alcoholic, you understand. I'm drinking over 2 quarts a day just to stay even. And you don't need a lot of alcohol when you're on Thorazine in the hospital. But when I got out of the hospital, I knew I had something to need, something to drink. And so I had a quart of vodka and a quart of scotch, and I stayed drunk that weekend, and I tried to go to work on Monday, and I couldn't get on the fourth rung of the ladder to change some light bulbs, which is not overly technical, and I just couldn't do it. I told the lady I'll come back another day, and I checked in with another psychiatrist because that was my answer. I knew that it wasn't for drinking, it was just there was something wrong, and if I could just find out and get some therapy from some psychiatrist, I'd be all right. And so I lied to him, and I drank through all the sessions. At Christmas of 65, I asked God to grant me some peace. And 2 days later, my answer came. I didn't realize it was an answer, but I woke up on a Tuesday morning, and I could see what I was drinking. And 2-3 hours later, although I was drunk, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to the Pacific Group that night on a Tuesday night at Ohio Street. And I sat in the back of the room you were supposed to sit when you knew, you know, don't get too close. And those little clubs, you know, you don't pick up any coffee cups or ice trays, I think you remember. And I sat back there in my hands, and I was frightened and scared. I had dark glasses on, so nobody would know I was drinking. And I had green slime coming out of my mouth and the breath purifier as I was chewing. Some jerk raised my hand for me as a newcomer, which I think was very nice. But I kept coming back. I kept drinking, but I kept coming back. So I finally walked up to a man who was my sponsor, Clancy, and he was in the kitchen doing some work in the kitchen in there with a bunch of his friends. And I said, "Excuse me, sir, you seem to be some sort of a big deal around here. How do you join Alcoholics Anonymous? How do you become a member?" He looked at me and he said, "You don't drink, kid." And obviously I was drunk. And he said, "Well, it's very easy for you to say. Apparently you're sober sometime. I can't go a whole day without a drink. I tried it one day in July and it damn near killed me." And he said, "Well, for you, maybe a half a day at a time. Ha, 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 ha." You know, and he had some of his friends and some of the guys he sponsors. And it's really kind of true. If you can't exploit and make fun of the new people, what good are they? You know, and so tearing out of there, went back to my psychiatrist. Because Clancy suggested that I not drink. And I told the psychiatrist about these crazy AA meetings. He said, "Not to worry." He gave me a whole big bag of Librium. So I got to through the rough spots. Well, I was so naive and stupid, I asked Clancy, "Well, I take these pills," and he explained to me very nicely. He said, "You know, you can do whatever you want to do." He said, "But, you know, if you're going to be sober, we don't drink here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we don't take pills in Alcoholics Anonymous with effects from the neck up. We don't smoke marijuana cigarettes. We don't shoot non-habit-forming heroin." And I think if I was coming in today, he'd probably tell me to cut back a little bit on the cocaine and crack I was taking. I don't know. But he tried to show me that to be sober is to be sober is to be sober. And if you're taking anything that affects you from the neck up, you're not sober. And it's hard for any of us to believe this and understand all this whole thing, because I think about what I used to be like at this time I'm talking about, and I can't imagine going a day without something. It's just, I just can't even imagine it. And so he suggested that I walk up and down the Santa Monica Beach and shake it out, or whatever. He told me to drink some Carol syrup and some soft drinks or whatever, and I called him on the phone and did all that kind of stuff, and I walked and took the Carol syrup and Cokes, and I didn't drink all that day. I went to a meeting that night, and I realized when I was sitting in the meeting that it was the longest time I'd been without a drink since I was a junior in high school. And I thought, how amazing, how miraculous. I couldn't believe it. And I didn't drink the next day. And of course I shook and I was sweating. And it was just a remarkable, awful thing to go through. But I don't ever have to do that again, because I stayed away from the first drink. That's something else I was told. You don't take the first drink. Now, I know that anyone that is new in the room that has been drinking knows it can't possibly be the first drink. How can it be the first drink? You don't even feel the first drink.
But it's the first drink that gets you drunk. Now, most people can't see that. But you don't take the first drink, and you're not going to get drunk. You're not going to set up that compulsion again. And so you don't pay attention to how you feel, or whether you want to drink, or whatever. You simply come into Alcoholics Anonymous, come to the meetings. You don't take the first drink, no matter how you feel about that. And you get a sponsor, and you get people that are growing up the same amount of weight you are to, the same age group, I guess, sobriety-wise. And you have your peers, that's what I have, and several in this room, guys that I've grown up with, and you hang together and do stuff with, and hang with people that are staying sober. And little by little by little, the miracle does happen. The miracle happened to me very shortly. The miracle was that I wasn't drinking. I realized that I wasn't drinking, and I was sober, and it was very foreign to me because I had not spent any time that way. My wife and I reconciled, we put the family back together again, and I had, I suppose, the obligatory honeymoon that people have, I guess, when we do all this sort of stuff. And it was a nice time, I guess. The newness of being sober, the newness of going to Alcoholics Anonymous, my new friends. The kids were still going to school, and we would have our problems in our marriage, but we were putting it back together again, and there was a chance. You see, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you have a chance. And that's what I was banking on. And as the years progressed, all of that changed, of course, but I look at those early days. I've thought a lot this year about what we did when I was new. I used to think, you know, you stop drinking, you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and life is just fun, you know, and whatever. But it was really tough those first few months, especially that first year. I think basically we decided one night at dinner, a bunch of us were talking, and all we did was just get up in the morning and go to work and maybe work the full day. I know many days I couldn't. I was too crazy, too ill, too insecure, too goofy. And I'd just come home and take a nap, or maybe just come and take a bath or a shower and get cleaned up, have dinner, go to Ohio Street and help set up the meeting and stay for the meeting, go out after coffee and stay bleary-eyed from staying up all night long practically, and have a little bit of sleep, get up and go to work, and that's about all we did. Go to work and ate our meals and went to meetings and kept our lives that simple and called our sponsors and did all that sort of boring stuff that we do. And little by little, all that was put back together again. I was made well again after the years went by. I started having problems in the marriage and in my business. I was more aware of them, I suppose. The financial problems continued on. I was easy for me to turn my life and my world over to the care of God, where like the weather was concerned or maybe what was on TV, but I wasn't going to turn over my business or my family. You can't turn an electrical contracting business to a higher power than have electricity in his day. How could he handle that routine? I couldn't understand that. And I prayed for a new Chevy van first year of my sobriety, and I got it just like that. Unfortunately, my higher power didn't send him enough work that season, so I had a, they came and repossessed it, which taught me to go back to praying only for the knowledge of his will for me and the power to carry that out, and I was doing that. But those early days were just wild and crazy. The kids started to get older, and they were getting in a lot of trouble at school and different stuff, and I was either too self-obsessed or too involved with Alcoholics Anonymous or too much desire to just be out of the house because I was very unhappy in that that household situation. My wife and I were not getting along. And I fell apart when I was sober about 8 or 9 or 10 months. I flipped out after a Friday night meeting, and I drove over to Clancy's house about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, drove over on his front lawn, incidentally. He came out and wanted to know why I wouldn't park in the street with the rest of the cars. And I said, I gotta talk to you now. I can't be wasting time parking the car. And so I parked the car, of course, and came in the house, and we sat around his coffee table and talked about what my problem was. And I couldn't figure out what my problem was. And I'm a very pragmatic person. I do electrical contracting work, and a lot of it is troubleshooting. And you try to find out what's wrong. You know, and you fix it, and give them a bill and go on your way. And sometimes life isn't that black and white. And he suggests I take a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, which is a fourth step. And I thought, I don't believe he would suggest this. After the years I had spent in the Catholic system of examination of conscience and confession, if that's not a fourth and fifth step, what is? And he seemed rather bored through all of that. So I told him I'd spent years with a psychiatrist, two psychiatrists, as a matter of fact, with several psychologists. And he seemed rather bored through that one. And he informed me that I was going to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It said somewhere that these are the steps we took and that I had to take a fourth step. And I was able to put in that fourth step against my better judgment, incidentally, things I was never able to tell a Catholic priest in confession, things that were too embarrassing, too tacky, too sinful, if you will. I mean, you can't tell a Catholic priest that kind of stuff. You know, it's just, you just kind of slide over it generally. And I can't tell a psychiatrist some of those other things because they'll think you're crazy. So you got to be real careful, very guarded. But I was able to be very open with him in this fourth step, in this fifth step. And he seemed rather bored through it all, as if he heard all before, and of course he had. And I've heard 3 or 4 dozen of them myself, and there's just so much you can do, and there's just so much you can think about, and there really are no big deals. And the longer I am sober, the more I am convinced that you can literally get through anything, anything at all, experience anything at all, if you simply come to Alcoholics Anonymous and don't drink. Don't take drugs. Come to meetings regularly. Get a sponsor. And as I said earlier, just get some friends that grow along, and you have these friendships that are just absolutely so precious. Just so precious. So Vince Yeo, for instance, the dearest man in this room to me. He's a true friend. The last 3 years, he has just been there for me, just like that. And all because he was asked to be a friend, and he's been that. And I'm really honored to be his friend. I wish I could. I told him that at dinner. I would never be able to repay the things that he has done for me. Not to mention the gifts. I started having some serious problems as the years went on, because the marriage was really getting out of hand. It was just a lot of separations back and forth and back and forth, a lot of financial problems that were ensued from because of my own irresponsibility, I would like to add. And the kids were getting the alcohol and drugs like they're supposed to. And I didn't know how to deal with a lot of this kind of stuff. We were not, this wife I was married to, she and I didn't see eye to eye on how to raise the kids or very much of anything. And these kids didn't have any stability, any kind of solidarity to grow up with, any kind of values like that. And so they were just all at sea in their own alcoholism and drug addiction. And I guess it was 1974 in January. Hard to believe, it's been a long time. She filed for divorce one more time, and this time I moved 80 miles away from where I had a business, where I had a family, where I had a home, and started life all over again. This little community of Dana Point, where I live near now. I live actually in Laguna Niguel now, but around that whole area. And as I was driving down the freeway, because I was giving up my business here, I was giving up my family, and I was going to start all life in these unknown areas, and I was very frightened, very insecure, but I had tested the waters, and it seemed like the right thing to do, but I wasn't too sure. And Clancy, a few years before, had given me a prayer that I say several times every day, and I was saying it then, and it goes like this: God, I have no idea where I'm going, I do not see the road ahead of me, and I cannot know for certain where to land, nor do I really know myself, and the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so, but I believe this. I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in everything I do, and I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know if I do this, you will lead me by the right road. Though I may know nothing about it at the time, though I may seem to be lost in the very shadow of death, I'll not be afraid, because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. And with this, I continued on down the freeway. And of course, I told him I got the problem I want, I want the business to run, none of which happened. I got a nicer apartment for a lot less money, and I got out of debt in a couple of years. And I wish I had moved years before. I don't like change. If something is shitty, I like it just the way it is, because I don't have to adjust. You know, I don't like to adjust. I like to know what the rules are, and I like the sameness and whatever. And yet my last 3 years of my life have been nothing but change. And I have to admit to myself and to you that I have become a well-adjusted person. The words stick in my throat, but it's really true, because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles that I have practiced so religiously over these last 22 years have made me a well-adjusted person. I can handle anything, anything at all that it's sent my way, I can adjust to and just go with. And it would not be possible. Imagine doing all that sober. It's just, it boggles my mind that I've been through what I've been through. I started to date when I was down there a short while, and that wasn't too easy. I'm 40-some-odd years old then, and I wasn't too good at high school, but I started doing it, and I dated one girl and another, and then I fell in love with a lady that she and I subsequently married. We had a wonderful relationship. I mean, we were very much in love with each other, which helps, of course. And we were both very active members of Alcoholics Anonymous and loved the program. And we all sponsored people. And we really kind of cared and shared for each other and with each other. And these kids started to float in and out of our lives. First one and then another. They weren't all there at one time, but they would stay with us or whatever. And I tried to be a better father than I had ever been. I tried to be a good husband to this lady. I try to be a good father to these kids of hers, and they had a lot of problems in those days, too. I pass it off sometimes like it was a big snap, but it was very difficult because they were not my children. And I love my own two sons, but other ones it's a little bit difficult. But I became a good father to those kids and love them very, very much. And I look back on my life now, and I'm a good man. I would have balked at that a few years ago, but I look at myself and what I have done in my life with God's help, and especially Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have become a good man in Alcoholics Anonymous. I became a good father, a good husband, a good manager of his business, and certainly a good, responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all of these things, I learned here, I practiced here, and I became this man that you see tonight. And I can hardly believe it because of this flake, this irresponsible person that was screwing up constantly and had just no chance of even getting by, that I have become the man that I am tonight. And I just, it's just really a great testimony to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, those years were difficult, putting the family together and all that kind of stuff. My youngest son, who just moved to Hawaii day before yesterday, I'm going to miss him very much, but he was the first one to get really into the alcohol and drugs from an outward sign. I have two sons, Chris and Jim, and Jim was the loud one. He always knew when he was loaded and cracking up stuff, and Chris was kind of more quiet and subtle, like my drinking story was. But he fell out of a second-story window, stoned on angel dust and some cheap wine, and I went to visit him and told him this is no way to live. And finally, a year later, through all of the lost jobs and the cracked up cars and all that sort of thing, Jim moved down to Dana Point and I put him to work, and he stayed sober in front of me, but not when I was not with him. And he got picked up for drunk walking one particular time. When he got out of the Santa Ana jail, he knew that he had to get sober, and he knew he was an alcoholic, but he knew that Alcoholics Anonymous wouldn't work, and so he quit on his own, just like that, with no program or anything. He did all on Quaaludes and marijuana, which is another... another program, but and I didn't know any of this was going on, and I remember it now. I just remembered it. Clint and I had a luncheon appointment at a little delicatessen in Tustin, and Jimmy was working for me then, and it was Clint and I just kind of talked Jimmy into coming to the meeting that night, which was a Wednesday night, because Norm Alpe, about our best speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous, was there, and Jimmy loved it, and he came back the following week, and he's this May 1st, he's going to have 9 years on the program, and I couldn't be more pleased for him. And Colleen, that was my wife's name, she had a daughter, daughter Kathy, and she was a burned-out cocaine addict. She couldn't get off the cocaine no matter how much alcohol she put in her system. And she left herself to die, slashed her wrist on a Marin County beach because she couldn't get off the stuff, and she couldn't go on any longer. How so many of us have been in that position. And somebody found her and put her in a hospital and sewed her up. And she was in a recovery house for about a year and a half. And she goes to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the last, seem to be 6 years, I guess, well, 5.5 years, she's a straight A. She's graduated. She graduates, I think, next month. And she's a straight A, 4.0 average up at Dominican College. And she's going to medical school next year. And she's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, married to a guy in the program. And 4.5 years ago, Chris came in here. 5.5 years ago, Chris came in here, and he's been a pride of my life to see his growth and what he's done with his life. And I'm so happy to always be in his company and his lovely wife, and it's just marvelous. And Colleen had another child, a stepson of mine, her youngest son. He was about 22 going on 12. And he had a lot more problems than alcoholism, but I look back on my life in December of 85. He's having one of his overdoses, and I'm in the emergency hospital with him and up in intensive care with him. And I forgot to tell you, my wife also had the disease of cancer, and she was in, it turned out to be her last stay in South Coast Hospital. That was a wild Friday night. This last year and a half, some friends of mine have told me they've watched me over these years with the wife dying of cancer and these crazy kids running around and trying to run a business and keep the bills together and make a nice home and love this lady and love these kids and do all this kind of stuff. And I didn't know what I was going through at the time, because I did, and I hate to give Clancy the credit for it, and it isn't really, it's really kind of true, because although we don't have the close relationship we once did, because I've moved quite a distance away, but from what he taught me, basically, on how to behave and how to act, I did precisely that. I acted well. I behaved myself. I was loving, caring, and I did the kind of job that I think that anyone would want done. And I have no regrets over that, except that my wife died the day after Christmas of 85. And the loss was just... it's really indescribable. If any of you have ever been involved with anyone who died of cancer for a long period of time, she lived 5 years longer than she was supposed to. A 10-year bout with the disease. And if any of you have been through it, you know what I mean, and any of you who haven't been, you don't want to know. But when she passed away, I was absolutely lost, because of all this that was going on all the time, it was just over. It was over. And I told Michael, that was my stepson, I said, I'll take care of you. Do whatever needs to be done. I said, your sponsor wants you to sign this contract. You go to AA meetings and help me in my business and attend two classes a week. It's Saddleback. And if none of these are taken care of, you can move out of the area. And I came home the next night, and I said, how was school? And he said, I didn't leave the house. And I said, I hope your bags are packed. And they were packed. And he moved out of my life, and the following Friday night, it was a couple of weeks. That was a week, I guess, after the end of the first of 1986. It was a Friday night. I was standing in my kitchen with packing boxes around, and I was crying, which is my natural state by now. And I thought, what am I going to do? And I did what I do. I went to an AA meeting. My sponsor was speaking. And I took my 20th cake. I lied to the group one more time and told them how happy, joyous, and free I was. And I didn't mean any of it, because the joy was gone. I had no more joy left. I've had some idea, some strange idea that my life was over, that I had done what I was put here to do, and I'd done it well, but it was over. And I really wanted to die. I had no desire to live anymore. I wasn't suicidal particularly. I just wanted to die. And I went to the meeting, and I continued to go to meetings. I kept doing my AA stuff. I got up every morning and ran on the beach when I didn't feel like it, or swam in the swimming pool for 55 minutes, which I still do every day, something like that. I ate my meals, I took my vitamins, I went to work every day, I showed up, I did what I was supposed to do when I was supposed to do it, because I'm a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got through that year. No joy, but I got through the year. I started a date last year, which was impossible. Dating program women is just absolutely impossible. I mean, you know, you ask them to go to a meeting or a baseball game or dinner, and you come home, you don't know whether to take them up to the front door and put your arms around them and give them a goodnight kiss, or simply hold their hands and say the Lord's Prayer. You know, it's all real dumb. That's what I did. And last year I saw a lady getting her fifth cake, and I asked her out. And we've been together ever since. Tomorrow's her sixth AA birthday, and I'm looking forward to sharing that with her. And we're going to be married at the end of this month, and I'm looking forward to that, because my life is happy, joyous, and free again. And I ain't no lie, because I hung around. I did not do what I felt like doing. We hear so often today of getting in touch with your feelings and all this other bullshit that you hear from the psychiatric. I guess that's fine. I suppose that's all fine. It'd be better left outside. Because if I had done what I felt like doing any time this last few years, or when I was a newcomer, which was to drink, or this last couple of years, which is just to drop out, I did what I knew was correct, the correct actions, and I took the correct actions. I remained sober. I did the right thing, and I hope to tell you that I'm sober, happy, joyous, and free, and it can happen for you if you just keep coming back. Get a sponsor. Hang with the people that are staying sober. It can happen for you. Thank you very much.